And our sermon text today is John 11, verses 28 to 44. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now, Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now, when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." Scientists have discovered an intriguing bacterium they call the Lazarus microbe, because it has the capability of dying and resurrecting over and over again. It has a robust genome with multiple copies of itself, such that although desiccated, radiated, showing no sign of metabolism, nevertheless it reconstitutes its own genome and thus reconstitutes its own life, says Miroslav Rodman of Paris University. Now, the process is complicated and still not completely understood. You can check this phenomenon out at livescience.com. But as Rodman puts it, once the genome is reconstituted, the cell can synthesize again all of its proteins, lipids, and membranes, and the cell resurrects. Rodman and his team hope to make application to human cell lines, opening up the possibility of resurrecting dead cells in our own bodies. Rodman says, "It allows us now legitimately to dream of bringing back to life dead or close to dead neurons." When thoroughly understood and widely applied, the science of the Lazarus microbe might extend life indefinitely and make of us all living, breathing Lazaruses. Imagine that. Potentially super extended life in this body and world that goes on indefinitely. Isn't that great? Maybe not. The question we must ask ourselves, is this the message our Lord intended to transmit to us in this last and greatest sign in the book of signs? Is the raising of Lazarus from the dead, as given us in this sign, meant to give us hope for mortal life on this side of eternity? Or is it meant to ground us in a hope for something greater, a life yet to come, in a sign yet to come? Your faith, my faith, our faith in that greater sign is to be strengthened and built up in this one, however. So let's look to our text today for that increased faith. Just 2 points I'd like to make with you from this narrative, this extended narrative. Seventh sign, part two. This is the seventh and greatest sign in the book of signs. And this is part two. Jesus of Nazareth, angered by the unbelief around him, calls forth faith from hearts entombed. Verses 28 to 37. Our Lord calls forth faith from hearts entombed. We are told that Martha immediately goes to her sister Mary and discloses in private, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." She does this after her confession, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." There is an implicit hope that the confession of Mary will be as full of faith as that of Martha. Our Lord, called teacher, that is the rabbi, is calling for her. Our Lord is calling for her. It's the same Greek verb that John uses for when Jesus calls out in a loud voice for Lazarus to come forth. The same verb. John is deliberately setting up a parallel between calling forth faith from dead, entombed hearts and that of calling forth Lazarus from his tomb of death. Everything in this section confirms this. And it's consistent with what our Lord is attempting to achieve in the disciples here and in the disciples who read this gospel too. That is you and me. Believe in him who raises the dead, and you too will be raised from the dead. And Mary, when she hears it, arises. The pun is intended here. The verb is the same that is used throughout the Gospel and Acts for raising Jesus from the dead. And she goes to him, even as Lazarus will arise and go out of the tomb to Jesus. John is narrating. John is narrating from the lesser sign to the greater sign. That is, the raising of Lazarus to the raising of Jesus. But even before that, there is an arising to faith in the heart of Mary. When we speak of salvation, we speak of God's call as a part of the order of his saving us, don't we? Taking through the deacons just this past Friday, through the Ordo Salutis, the order of salvation. Which is laid out in our confession of faith. And the call, the efficacious call, is that first step. Here, our Lord is calling for Mary. And that call is indeed for her to come to faith. Those whom he has predestined, Paul puts it in Romans chapter 8, he has also called. And those whom he called, he also justified, and those whom he justified, he also glorified. Our Lord is calling forth faith in Mary from her entombed heart. And here our Lord is calling forth Mary to faith in himself in the case of her brother Lazarus. And he is doing this long before he even stands before the tomb. That is, long before anyone might expect him to do so. That is the sense of now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. Will faith precede sign? Will faith precede sign? Well, not if the official mourning entourage has its way. They dutifully follow Mary since they assumed that she was going to the tomb to mourn there. This was a common accepted practice among the Jews at this time in their culture. A grieving relative would regularly repair to the place of burial to weep and mourn. And those close to the deceased were expected to join family members in this ritual, especially if they were paid mourners. When she reaches Jesus, she demonstrates her devotion by falling at his feet. And his faith and her faith in her confession. That confession will repeat Martha's baby step of faith when she confirms her trust in Jesus that he could have healed the stricken Lazarus, right? Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And that's verbatim what Martha had said to him as well. Jesus steps back to take stock of the situation and sees a pathetic scene. Mary's weeping, the Jews are weeping, and his reaction demands an exegetical decision as to what the Greek verb embrimaomai means. Embrimaomai. What does this verb mean? It can mean one of several things. It can mean deeply moved, as it's translated here, but translated only here in this way. Or it can mean anger and outrage and emotional indignation. In secular Greek, it's regularly used for horses snorting. And the verb occurs three other times in the New Testament. Brian read one of those for us today. In Matthew chapter 9, the two blind men, after their eyes had been healed, after their eyes were opened, Jesus sternly warned them, the same verb that's used here, sternly warned them, see that no one knows about it. Or in Matthew 9:30, Jesus sternly charged him and sent him away at once, the healing taking place there. The idea was sternly charging. And in Mark 1:43, those around the woman who anointed our Lord said, this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor. And they scolded her. There's that idea of embrimaomai, scolding, sternly warning. Now, it is most likely that this is the sense of Jesus' reaction to what he sees going on around him. As Dr. Carson puts it, he says, it is lexically inexcusable to reduce this emotional upset to the effects of empathy, grief, pain, or the like. And after looking at this all week, I have to agree with him. Our Lord is indignant in spirit and troubled for reasons we have already seen specified. First of all, the resurrection is already a promise that tempers our despair. The resurrection is already a promise that should temper our despair. Martha has just confessed her belief in the resurrection that was shared by a majority of those there that day. Why then all of the over-the-top emotional grief, many of it cynical and paid for? These, even Mary, were grieving like pagans, like the rest of men who have no hope, as Paul puts it in 1 Thessalonians. Maudlin emotionalism has no place in the Christian approach to death. We see it in the difference, even today, between the deaths of believers and the deaths of pagans. We have no right to grieve like pagans. Secondly, Jesus has just promised that he will raise Lazarus. to be kept in mind what Jesus told the disciples at the outset. Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. Implicit in his journey to Bethany is the soon anticipation of the performance of this great sign. So, that sense of indignation steals his will to raise the beloved Lazarus, prompting him to inquire, "Where have you laid him? Where have you laid him?" And their simple, elegant response is what prompts him to weep. They say, "Come and see. Come and see." Now, keep in mind that the words of this narrative are chosen out of a head, not out of a hat. Previously, this phrase, "come and see," was a call to discipleship of new life, not death. These words have a track record in this gospel. Back in chapter 1, for example, when Andrew and another disciple sought to follow Jesus by asking where he was staying, our Lord invited them, "Come and see." So they came and saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him for that day, for it was about the 10th hour. Or, also in chapter 1, Philip invited Nathanael to follow Jesus. Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" And Philip said to him, "Come and see." Now that invitation is not implicitly for life and hope, but mourning and death. This is why our Lord wept. That is, because faith was entombed, not because of sentimental feeling for a deceased friend. He will soon be standing before them. But will faith be created? Will belief in the author of life manifest itself? It is being called forth from entombed hearts. But alas, that will not happen until after Jesus' own resurrection. And so Jesus wept. The ancient church father Peter Chrysologus points out that there are three different classes of people weeping here. Mary is weeping. The Jews are weeping. Jesus is weeping. There's a lot of weeping going on here. And Chrysologus asks, he says, "Do you think they all weep for the same reason?" And of course, he concludes that none of them weep for the same reason. Mary weeps because she was not able to hold on to her brother or prevent him from dying. The Jews weep because they see in Lazarus' death their own eventual mortal fate. And Jesus weeps because, as Chrysologus says, when he inquires of them and sees no faith in those who answer him. That is why our Lord is weeping. He sees no faith in those who answer him. And John marks the misreading of our Lord's weeping by the Jews in verses 36 and 37. He marks their misreading. One party thinks it is insipid emotion that moves him. See how he loved him. Now, I don't mean to say that Jesus did not love Lazarus, so don't get me wrong on this. Maybe this jangles you a little bit. It's not an understanding of this text that we're familiar in common with, right? It is just to say that that is not the sum total, the complete reason as to why Jesus weeps. Another party sees his weeping as a kind of lament over being impotent to do anything about Lazarus' dying. Could he not have he opened the eyes of the blind man, also kept this man from dying? In their eyes, Jesus is weeping because he couldn't do anything to prevent the death of Lazarus. But is this the case? We already know that he could well have done, but is anticipating something greater, a greater sign. And that brings us to point two. Seventh sign, part two. Jesus of Nazareth, countering the unbelief around him, calls forth Lazarus from his earthly tomb. Countering the unbelief around him, he calls forth Lazarus from his earthly tomb. Now, our Lord's reaction to the presumptions of the Jews is consistent with our interpretation that rather being deeply moved, that is emotionally distraught, he is rather indignant and perturbed again. Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave and a stone lay against it. Our Lord is indignant at the absence of faith so prevalent here at the entrance of the tomb. From the beginning, with the very first sign, up to now, at this place and at this time, he has demonstrated his power over the forces of nature and all creation. And he has heralded what he is about to do. Back in verse 4, this illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. He has proclaimed that the power of life is his and resident within him. He is the author of life at creation and that which will be present at the recreation of all things. He has just told them, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? Enough evidence has been given, enough foreshadowing spoken, that all there, especially Mary and Martha, should have quietly anticipated the emergence of their brother Lazarus from the tomb. Rather than any measure of shock or surprise, and certainly not the unbelief that still lingers over the scene like a bad odor, there should have been a faithful expectation prior to and great joy following the emergence of the beloved disciple from his tomb. All of this is meant to show the utter necessity of our Lord's own resurrection for faith to take on its ultimate saving power. That will happen after the resurrection of our Lord. What a contrast. How lethargic and sluggish is the faith of even the faithful before Jesus' resurrection. Once again, it's been brought home to me how patient and loving is Jesus during his earthly ministry and the showing and doing of the seven signs. These signs have been patiently and lovingly done by our Lord. They are patiently, lovingly recorded by the apostle. But the saving faith which they engender requires one last key element, the resurrection of the Lord of life himself, Jesus of Nazareth. And subsequently, it will be the disciples who read and hear preached the book of signs. Within their breasts is created the saving faith which will create the church. It is the resurrection of Christ which will bring all of these signs together to kick in the afterburners of faith, if you will, the second stage liftoff power that will put saving faith into orbit, the resurrection of Jesus. There pervades the whole Gospel of John this sense that it is the readers of the Gospel who have the real advantage. The post-resurrection disciples, us, not necessarily the ones who were present during the ministry of our Lord. They were kind of groping around in grave clothes, so to speak, not having a full picture of what lay ahead. And that will come with the resurrection of Jesus himself. Until then, the immature baby faith of the disciples is that which our Lord must cope with. That's made evident in Martha's response to Jesus' command to take away the stone. Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days. How exasperating. What did she think was going to happen with this significant development, roll away the stone? Did she think that he wistfully wanted one last look at the body of his friend, as one commentator puts it? A body that every thinking person knew was in a sufficient state of decay by this time that the sicky sweet smell of death lingered over it. What her answer does is betray her expectations. That he was dead yesterday, he was dead now, and would remain dead until the general resurrection. So the Lord reminds her, and by reminding her, he reminds us, now the readers of this gospel, reminds her of the cruciality of trusting him in this matter, if she will see the glory of God. It's already been promised. And then he patiently then includes those around him in a heavenly dialogue with his Father in order to bolster that faith. Once again, calling forth faith, if not in that generation, in ours. Generation subsequent to his own resurrection. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. Once again, for the faith of disciples. Such is the intimacy of the Father and the Son relationship that the raising of Lazarus is an accomplished fact and must only be inaugurated by a word. But in order to establish faith in the people, Jesus lets down a corner of the veil that all may see that it is the will of the Godhead that death has lost its power to hold its victims henceforth. That day is dawning. Peter Chrysologus says, again, I love this guy too. I've learned to love this guy as I've been reading through his commentary. He says, what is this? Christ began to knock at the entrance of hell, to break the gates of Tartarus, to open death's doors, to loosen the old law of Gehenna, to overthrow the most ancient law of punishment, to demand back the soul of Lazarus, and to create a pathway out of hell. A pathway out of hell, indeed, is being paved. So after closely linking faith with resurrection, that is what our Lord is doing, closely linking faith with resurrection, Jesus gives out that word of life. He cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out! Augustine says that such is the power of our Lord over life and resurrection that had he not specified Lazarus but had commanded in general come forth, that the great resurrection of all souls would have transpired then and there. Now, while that's true of Jesus' intrinsic power and certainly dramatic to ponder, we really have enough drama in what actually happened, right? The man who had died came out. Emphatic, the idea of the man who had died came out. The man, the Adam, the human, that embodied soul who had died a true death, stepped out of his tomb. A pathway out of hell is being pioneered for man. And a fledgling first fruit of the resurrection is sprouted here in the presence of the Lord of life. And yet there's something deficient in it, something yet incomplete. his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped in a cloth. The trappings of death and the world still encumbers him, which our Lord directed to be removed. This is certainly not the glorious resurrection of the body which Paul writes of in 1 Corinthians 15, is it? That remains for another day. And we will revisit the linen and the headscarf in Jesus' tomb. John makes a meticulous point of it, doesn't he? But for now, this drama is a resurrection of the body to life in this continuum and circumstances and world. Lazarus will die again. But it is a sign. And signs were given to create faith in the disciple. John has been reminding us of this again and again and again, hasn't he? Jesus did many other signs, John would say, in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. John writes his gospel with an eye to his audience, an eye to his reader, and the presumed congregant with whom the preacher is exhorting. That would be you. This sign is given to you that you may go on to trust our ascended Lord to raise you from the dead. Inexorable death is but a door to new life for us. It has no enduring power over you, if indeed you trust Christ to call you forth from the grave on that day. If you hear his voice in the text today calling you, as John very deliberately intended you, then respond in faith to him, that you too may have new life in him. That voice should be becoming familiar enough now in this gospel that it will be familiar to you on that day too. When you hear Mike come forth, Nick come forth, Lindsay come forth, Jeff come forth, Brian come forth, right? Is the voice in the text clear enough to you, resonate with you in your heart and your soul, that it will be familiar to you on that day? Believe in him today for that life, and you will hear his voice on that day. Until then, let us now come then to that place where we see another sign of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ in his body and blood, in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.